my guys are still under a judicial estrangement order. That blue thing I got from her.
I've got the best lawyer soft tacos can buy.
Objection.
On what grounds?
How about silliness, Your Honor?
I think legal terms are magic words that can force people to do what I want.
My client has instructed me to remind the court how rich and important he is, and that he is not like other men.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 411. I'm Thomas, that's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I am fantastic as well. I'm excited for the return of Randall Eliason. It's been way too long. He's mentioned all the time on this show.
Yeah, no, we call him friend of the show, but lately he's been, you know, frenemy of the show. So we've got to.
Oh, okay.
Well, maybe not. So yes, I am even more fantastic than usual, awaiting the illustrious return of our friend Randall Eliason.
Well, before we get to that, we're going to talk about something that got wiped off the whiteboard because of the huge news over the NRA. So I'm glad we have this time now to do that.
Down
the law,
down
the law,
down
the law,
down
the law.
We talked a lot in the SIO you did, as I mentioned the other week. We talked a lot about how Trump might steal the election, how he might try to limit voting by mail and all that stuff. And there's just always more questions on this. And I know you have an update on this, and people are worried about what he might do still to jeopardize voting by mail. So what's your update?
So this, I think, fits nicely into that discussion, and it is taking a look at a bipartisan bill just passed in Nevada, looking at Trump's response to that Nevada bill, which, by the way, was to sue for an injunction to block this particular piece of legislation from going into place. And as always, right, with Donald Trump, you know, there's a tweet for that, right? Maybe we should start with that, because I think it reinforces a key point that you made on SIO that I think is not getting airtime in, you know, our circles, in left-wing circles. And it is this: voting by mail in and of itself is not necessarily going to advantage one particular party or another, right? It is entirely conceivable to construct a vote-by-mail system that would help Republicans. Here's really good intuitive proof of that. On the same day, Trump sent two different tweets. This was last week. Trump said, "Absentee voting is great. It works. Like in Florida, they'll do absentee. It really works. But universal mail-in ballots is going to be a great embarrassment to our country."
Uh-huh.
And on the same day, he writes, "Nevada has zero infrastructure for mail-in voting. It will be a corrupt disaster if not ended by the courts. It will take months or years to figure out. Florida has a great infrastructure over years with two great Republican governors. Florida, send in your ballots." So that's kind of a tell, isn't it?
Yeah.
That Trump is in favor of voting by mail in Florida and opposed to voting by mail in Nevada. And it's really, really easy
to
see.
Yeah,
why.
There's no way we can decode this one, Andrew.
Yeah. It's super easy to decode. And that is because Nevada's recently passed, this is AB4 is the code on it, Assembly Bill 4. It is now law in the state of Nevada. And it following sort of the breakdown that we did on SIO, establishes a second category of voting within the state, right? And that category is now mail ballot as opposed to an absentee ballot, right? And we talked about how voting by mail in most states is a subset of the absentee balloting process. And then the question becomes, does the state require you to give an explanation or an excuse for why you cast an absentee ballot? Do they say that COVID is presumptively an excuse for that? Or, you know, do they require you to jump through some other kind of hoop? That's why Trump likes absentee ballots, particularly in a state like Florida, which says, hey, you have to cast an absentee ballot. You have to give an excuse. And by the way, being over 65 is a presumptively valid excuse, right? That has to do with the demographics of people who are Trump supporters. Nevada tried to and succeeded, and I think that Trump's lawsuit has zero chance of success. We're going to break it down. What Nevada did was create a separate class of mail ballots, and they provided that every registered voter is going to get a mail ballot. That ballot will come with a self-addressed stamped return envelope and a special little envelope to ensure that your vote is secret, right? Like, in other words, this is providing real infrastructure to get mail-in ballots in the hands of individuals well in advance of the election, and to treat it as a process separate from the absentee balloting process, right? So to try and expand the electorate, as I pointed out, this bill was widely bipartisan in Nevada. It was passed 29-12 in the assembly and 13-8 in the Senate.
Pretty sparse numbers in their state Congress.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, is anybody here? We're going to do a bill. There's a couple. I see a few over there. Okay, let's pass a bill. Like 20 people.
What is interesting is that the lawsuit that Trump has filed is predicated on exactly one provision. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But the provision that it's predicated on is not the thing that bothers Donald Trump from a political standpoint, right? What bothers Donald Trump is that Nevada got together and said, we're going to create a new mail-in voting system. It's not going to require you to give an excuse, and we're going to put those ballots in the hands of every registered voter in the state. Keeping in mind, by the way, that Nevada is one of the places where Trump can play offense in 2020. There are not a lot of these. The map strongly favors Joe Biden at the moment, right? In the sense that if you take just Hillary Clinton's results and swing Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, all of which have shown very healthy leads for Joe Biden at current polling time, then that reverses the result of the election. And also, Democrats have polled well and have made serious inroads in states like North Carolina, Florida, and Arizona. So places to go on the offense. However, there are places that Donald Trump can go on the offense, right? So Nevada is one of those states. Minnesota is one of those states. New Hampshire is one of those states. So in those areas, right, the idea is to implement the Republican playbook, to make it as hard as possible for Democrats to vote and as easy as possible for Republicans to vote. That's what they want to do. So it makes sense that Trump has sued for an injunction blocking AB 4 from going into effect. And that hearing will be any day now.
Sorry, if I'm missing something obvious, what even would be the grounds for the president to sue a state for a bill that they're doing to make their election a little better in the time of COVID?
So let's go through it. And as always, let's use the OA method of reading the complaint, starting at the
Larry
caption and then
Klayman.
Reading backwards.
Oh, no.
Yep. Close. So first we look at the caption, and they have sued Barbara Segovsky in her official capacities, the Nevada Secretary of State. The plaintiffs are the Republican National Committee, the Nevada Republican Party, and Donald J. Trump for President Incorporated, right? That is the president's reelection campaign, but not the president himself, right? And why is the president's reelection campaign the one bringing this lawsuit? Because that way he can pay his lawyer, Bill Consovoy, we're going to skip to the signature block in a minute, out of campaign contributions.
Right,
so yes,
right.
That's right. Your dumbass uncle in the MAGA hat who just sent 10 bucks to keep America great again or whatever, all of that money could be sent to Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Bill Consovoy, because he also represents the Trump campaign.
Look, there's a real theme of, I don't know if you'd call it embezzlement. What would you call this?
Grift?
Grift. Yeah, thank you. There's a real grift theme to the show lately.
Yeah.
Could it be that this lawyer is just feeding Trump all kinds of nonsense about the kind of cases that he might be able to win if he does it just so he can bilk money out of the campaign?
That would be, again, let us be perfectly clear so that Bill Consovoy does not sue us. Number one, Bill Consovoy is a terrible lawyer. Okay. Sue us on that one, big boy. Bring it on.
Hey, I bet you he's making more than you, Andrew.
I cannot prove that he has a super wealthy client who has found an unlimited pot of money that he doesn't care about paying people out of and is inducing Donald Trump to file idiotic lawsuits out of that giant pot of money. But I can say that his conduct is consistent with somebody who. Mm-hmm.
So what can I say as someone who doesn't care about getting disbarred or something?
Yeah. You seems can say fishy. That. Consovoy's oral arguments have been as underwhelming as anybody not named Larry Klayman that you have ever seen. So we page down to the caption. This is Bill Consovoy, who, again, it cannot be overstated how terrible a lawyer he is. Right? Like he's not in Jay Sekulow territory, but like he's in that next pile of crap up of like just incompetence, right? And has been repeatedly ill prepared in every case in which I have seen him argue or draft pleadings, and this is another good example of that, right? So this lawsuit, 25 pages long. Now we get to go to the five counts, and I am not going to talk about counts 2 through 5 because counts 2 through 5 are garbage. They're so bad that I don't think William Consovoy expects to win on them. Right. So you've asked, what are the grounds for the Trump campaign to sue a state for making its voting easier? Counts 2 through 5 are various allegations that the law violates the Equal Protection Clause. And as you know, from our extensive discussion on Equal Protection Clause jurisprudence, with the exception of cases involving gender, which fall under intermediate scrutiny, in general, Equal Protection Clause cases fall on one of two polar extremes, right? Either you are litigating on behalf of discrimination against a protected class or for a fundamental right. And that gets strict scrutiny, and the law is almost certainly struck down because it must be narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling governmental interest in the least restrictive means possible. Right? Those are typically classifications on the basis of race, for example, right? Or the law draws classifications on the basis of a non-protected class and not a fundamental right, at which point you get rational basis scrutiny and the law is upheld, right? So good example of that, if a state were to pass a law that said, no shirt, no shoes, no service law, right? Like, well, that would discriminate against a class of people, right? It would discriminate against the class of people who go into the 7-Eleven without a shirt on.
Haters?
But it absolutely would make a prima facie case of discriminating between two classes of people. But we don't think shirt wearing is the kind of class that deserves heightened protection. So you would just have to show a rational basis. That rational basis would be, hygiene, for example, right? Like, it's kind of gross to go into the 7-Eleven without your shirt on, put a damn shirt on. And that would be it, right? So Equal Protection Clause, and I know before you write in, I'm oversimplifying, but it can be oversimplified in this case. That's your quick and dirty guide to Equal Protection Clause violations. right? So count two alleges that it's violating the right of rural voters in the state of Nevada. Well, you know what? Living in rural areas is not a protected class under the Constitution, right? And all of these counts are going to be resolved on a rational basis standard, and Trump has not a shot in hell of winning any of them. So that leaves count one. Count one is interesting. It's interesting because it says that there is a violation of 3 U.S.C. 1, 2 U.S.C. 7, 2 U.S.C. 1, together, the Federal Elections Act, right? And the Elections Clause, the Electors Clause, and the Supremacy Clause. What does all of that mean? That is a bad lawyer's way of pleading for a declaratory judgment on one incredibly narrow provision of Nevada AB 4. And I'm going to read that provision to you first and then let you guess as to what you think the argument being raised by Bill Constable is. Okay.
Yeah. You're really good. It's going to be hard for me to get into the mind of a bad lawyer, but I'll try.
Section 20 of the bill is the eligibility of a mail ballot. 1A says if the ballot is before the time set for the closing of the polls, delivered by hand to the county or city clerk as applicable, or at any ballot drop box established in the county or city as applicable, right? So that makes total sense, right? During election day, if you drop it off at the appropriate office or in one of the drop boxes, the ballot counts. Section B, if it's mailed to the county or city clerk, and it's either postmarked on or before the day of the elections, November 3rd, and received by the clerk not later than 5 p.m. on the seventh day following the election. Mail's super slow for all of the reasons that we may have discussed on SIO. Long as it's postmarked the day of the election, it gets in, it's fine. Trump does not challenge either of those two provisions. Here's what he does challenge. 20, subsection 2. If a mail ballot is received by mail not later than 5 p.m. on the third day following the election, and the date of the postmark cannot be determined, the mail ballot shall be deemed to have been postmarked on or before the day of the election.
Hmm.
That seems totally straightforward, right? You can completely understand why that, right? Like it's rain. I mean, it doesn't rain much in Nevada, but you know, it's dust storming and, you know, or there's a guy with a sweaty hand and, you know, that little stamp that says postmark November 3rd, you're looking at and you're like, is that a 3 or a 2 or an 8? I don't know, whatever. You need to have some kind of process for determining, okay, well, where's our cutoff? How are we going to figure out if this is a valid ballot or not? And that is, okay, it's either got the right postmark or we can't tell what the postmark is, but we got it within 3 days of the election, right?
Seems straightforward.
That is, I want to tell you this and I want to be perfectly clear about it. That is the only provision of this law, which is 54 pages long. This is one sentence. That is the only provision that count one of Trump's lawsuit challenges. Any ideas why?
Honestly, no. I cannot think of what the problem with that very straightforward, reasonable provision of this law would be.
Here's the argument, and then I'll give you my assessment. Okay. The argument is that the Federal Elections Act requires that every state hold the election for the president on the next Tuesday after the first Monday in November, in every fourth year succeeding every election of a president and vice president, right? So that is November 3rd. It is possible under Section 20.2 for a ballot to be cast after Election Day, then stuck in the mail, have the postmark get obscured.
Oh, yeah.
And show up.
What if? What a fantastical conspiracy. Wow.
But I want to describe the legal basis for this first, because look, the legal basis is not super strong, but put an asterisk by it.
The practical basis is even stupider.
The practical basis, let's talk about that one first, is insane. Okay. You have to posit a conspiracy whereby Trump wins Nevada, and now everybody who doesn't want Trump to win Nevada goes out, fills out these ballots after the election, obscures the postmark, and arranges for them to be delivered. Like, what even is that, right? Like, it is, if you have that level of organization, just
they
vote on
election. They could just vote on the day.
Right. Yeah. You gain no advantage other than like, okay, well, I don't have to, right? Like, why would I do that? Why would I vote if I'm going to win anyway? It is bonkers. And again, you have to figure out some way, because Section 20-2 only applies if the postmark is obscured. Right. Like, if you can't determine what it is, and you have to hope that they not only screw up your postmark, but get it there in 2 days or less.
Yeah.
Right. Like, if your mail carrier is slow, great scheme, thwarted by dude in a car with no wind, with no doors.
You can't like pre-wet the envelope either. Like, they have to obscure it. Right. It goes through the machine. I'm guessing. Right.
Yep. That's exactly right.
This is the
dumbest thing imaginable. It on a practical level, on a legal basis, the argument passes the straight face test. I mean, just barely. But it comes from a case called Foster versus Love, 1997 case involving the Louisiana open primary system, right? And that Supreme Court case basically said, look, the way the Louisiana open primary system works is everybody's on the ballot. And then if there is not an outright winner, if nobody gets a majority of votes, then you have the runoff. And so the way in which the system was working was it was possible that the primary would determine the winner before election day, right, under the old system. And so that was challenged, right, by the political parties that said, no. Election day has to be on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. So Louisiana, you can't be picking your senators and representatives in October. And the Supreme Court said yes, right? The Supreme Court said that the Federal Elections Act requires that election be held on that day. Now, I think there's a huge, and this was in about 20% of cases, right? There was no runoff, and so there was a clear winner. So, I think that is manifestly distinguishable, right? I think the difference between we regularly schedule this runoff election that is going to be before election day, like that clearly violates the Federal Election Act. Saying, this crazy Rube Goldberg scheme of hypothetical obscured ballots coming in that then swings the election, like that seems beyond speculative. But now let me say this. If I were a district court judge, I would issue a preliminary injunction only as to Section 20-2. Never minding the fact that this is incredibly thin. I would dismiss it on the other, right? The other counts are garbage. No court, no matter how partisan, is going to enter any relief on the other counts. If you grant the stay, you now take the power out of the hands of the appellate courts and the Supreme Court of the United States to come back and say you should have issued a stay, right? This is the only potentially winning argument they have. And issuing a stay now has zero effect on what Trump really doesn't want to have happen, right? What Trump doesn't want to have happen is to have statewide vote by mail with everybody getting the ballots.
Oh, so they would do a stay just for the smeared postmark case.
Yeah, you would say,
fine. This is, have at it.
This is severable. Look, this doesn't even come into play for months, right? Like, you would have plenty of opportunity. The legislature could amend it, right? Like, we could promulgate new regs. We could have a case on the merits, right? Like, there's so many ways to resolve this. But
good point.
If I were the judge, I would be like, yep, okay, congratulations. You got your relief. Here you go. Yeah. Injunction blocking 20-2 from going. We agree with you in your entire, you have a substantial likelihood of success on the merits.
Tell you what, we'll send you the one ballot that this applies to and you can frame it.
Yep. Yeah. And that is it.
Wow. Some strategy talk there. I like that.
That's my advice.
I wasn't totally sure when you were going into that, but after you broke it down, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. And we are now joined by Randall Eliason. How are you doing, Randall?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Just so happy to have you back. It's been far too long.
Thank you. Thrilled to be back.
Why don't we start with the issue that I think is nearest and dearest to our hearts right now, where we have filed an amicus brief, the status of what's going on with Michael Flynn, Judge Sullivan. This is the craziest. I mean, I'm not wrong that this is the craziest federal criminal prosecution in history, right?
I think that's probably right. Yeah. Wow. I've never seen anything like it. It really has become almost a circus. It's gotten so far away from the underlying merits of what Flynn did and what sentence he deserves at this point.
Let's go back to that, right? Because I think it was your first appearance on the show in which, you know, we invited you to speculate a little bit about what seemed to be a pretty fantastic sweetheart deal for Michael Flynn. And as befitting your calm and cautious demeanor, you did not take the bait of saying, well, this is definitely a sign that he's going to roll on somebody higher up the food chain.
Right.
But I think you did. I think you were at least, you know, sort of 70 or 80% on board with, from a prosecutorial standpoint, you know, taking somebody who has multiple different violations, giving them a total walk on the Forrest stuff, and something that, you know, wound up being a 0 to 6 month sentencing recommendation on the false statement stuff, seemed pretty good, right? Like, in your experience, that seemed like a pretty good deal.
Well, of course, it turns out now, according to William Barr, he should never have been prosecuted at all. So even I was being too harsh, right? I mean, I'm always reluctant. I mean, we're looking back to the original plea deal, but I'm always a little reluctant to second guess things like that from the outside, having been the prosecutor and seeing things that I've done in investigations sort of misrepresented in the press or misunderstood, because, you know, the public doesn't have nearly all of the information that goes into making those kinds of decisions. It's all protected by grand jury secrecy, and there are a lot of things that we probably don't know. So I wasn't, you know, outraged or surprised or anything by the plea deal at the time, especially since it involved cooperation. And he did, you know, cooperate for some time before he sort of changed course.
before he got wise.
Yeah.
I want to do a quick sidebar on that. I'm really glad you said that. We made a similar point, you know, right after the favorable Supreme Court ruling in Trump v. Vance, that there was a hit piece going around. Mm. We don't need to mention it, that, you know, was second guessing Cy Vance's non-prosecution decision, you know, from 8 years ago with respect to Trump. And I made a similar point, right?
Yep, I remember that.
That I think that's right. That there is, I think it's worth emphasizing, there are a lot of irregularities. There are a lot of reasons to be more suspicious in this administration than in past administrations. But we do have kind of a dark veil over a lot of the evidence when it comes to prosecution and non-prosecution.
As the lone layperson here, it gets a little, I guess, overwhelming to see stuff like what happened with the Jeffrey Epstein, you know, with that he could be not behind bars for so long because of what seemed like perhaps way too good of a deal. I mean, there's got to be a line where it's like, okay, this can't be above board, right?
Sure. It's perfectly fair to ask questions. Don't get me wrong, to question what prosecutors do and, you know, to look back on things that they've done and critique them and things like that. I'm always try to be a little bit cautious about second guessing without having all the facts, right? Mm-hmm. And each case is different, but again, like in the Flynn case at the time that deal was done, that didn't strike me as crazy or unusual or anything. I mean, it's not the crime of the century, you know, lying during an FBI interview.
can I take that as legal advice?
Yes. But, you know, it does happen with some frequency, you know, so the guidelines were not very high and the chance to get his cooperation in exchange at the time seemed like, you know, to me, a perfectly reasonable step for Mueller to take. But of course, then Flynn changed course. You know, I guess it was last summer when he hired Sidney Powell. Changed course, probably putting it mildly.
And let's be clear on that, right? Like, part of the cooperation on the Forrest stuff was, the government anticipated that he would be the star witness in the Bijan Khan case.
Right.
And he wound up intervening on behalf of the defendant, right? And his and Sidney Powell's behavior was so bewildering. Flynn's behavior was criticized by both the Bijan Khan prosecutors and Keon's lawyers, right? Like, which is a pretty rare occurrence that,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, that things really went south, I guess, is when the government thought that he had changed up on them in anticipation of his testimony in that trial. And then everything went downhill from there.
Yeah. So that's sort of revisiting. Let's talk about Rule 48A motions. In general, how frequently does the government file a 48A motion requesting leave of court to dismiss charges against a criminal defendant?
I'm trying to remember if I ever did one in 12 years. I don't recall it. I mean, I think it's pretty rare, but there can certainly be reasonable grounds to do it, right? You can certainly discover new information post-indictment that leads you to decide the case should not be pursued, or that, you know, there's some material you didn't know about at the time and that the charges are, in fact, not appropriate. And so you need, in the interest of justice, to drop them. And that's perfectly appropriate. Mm-hmm. In fact, we want prosecutors to have that kind of a vehicle, right? So there can be legitimate reasons for dismissing a case once it's filed. What was, I think, unprecedented with the Flynn case, at least I haven't seen any other prosecutors, you know, on Twitter or anywhere else, you know, come up with other examples. We're trying to think of one where, after a guilty plea where the defendant has pleaded guilty twice and admitted under oath that he committed the offense, for the government then to come in and drop it. So that's what's one of the many things that's pretty remarkable about this particular Rule 48A motion.
We represented in our amicus brief that there are zero cases in which the government has moved under Rule 48A to dismiss all charges against a criminal defendant who has already pled guilty, right? There are a handful of edge cases that we talked about that, you know, that appear. All of those, I think, are Ninth Circuit cases, never happened in D.C., and never happened where the government is saying, you've pled guilty, but now we will hear none of it, sir.
Right. And of course, what made this one particularly shocking was not just the fact that they did that, but then the grounds that they gave were so bogus. I mean, the arguments about why he didn't really commit a 1001 violation at all, and how there was no legitimate investigative reason to interview him. I mean, they're just nonsense. And the legal arguments contradict DOJ's consistent position in false statements cases for years in terms of materiality and what the statute requires. And so it was just such a transparent, bogus motion. So it's not just the fact that he'd already pleaded guilty, but then, you know, the grounds they supposedly gave for taking these extraordinary steps were just nonsense.
The plain language of 48A says requires leave of court, right? That seems to be, as we would say, you know, case closed.
It's got to mean something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was bewildering to me when the D.C. Circuit on a 2-1 Naomi Rao opinion granted mandamus relief to Michael Flynn, because mandamus, you know, as we've discussed on the show, is that's what you get when a governmental official has zero discretion, right? And leave is defined as discretion, right? I mean, it just seems so completely clear to be inappropriate.
To get mandamus, your right to relief has to be clear and indisputable. That's the standard. And you have to have no alternative remedy.
Right.
And Flynn fails both those prongs because the Supreme Court's never decided whether a trial judge can deny, or, you know, a Rule 48A motion when both sides agree. And there are some lower court cases that suggest that the court can consider whether the dismissal, even though both sides agree, might be contrary to the public interest before granting leave of court. And that's what you've got here. And how does the judge make that determination if the judge can't even hold a hearing, right? So, but at the bare minimum, I mean, you've got to say it's not clear and indisputable that Sullivan had to grant this motion. At least there's an issue there. And in terms of no alternative remedy, his remedy is what every litigant's remedy is. You get the judge to decide and then you appeal.
So let me ask you a question that I can't figure out, right? Because I agree 100% with what you've said. I thought that was the stronger argument. And so, you know, now we're gonna talk a little bit procedurally, right? After that opinion came out, we waited till the very last day. None of the judges on the D.C. Circuit requested mandamus review. But then Judge Sullivan, by and through his attorney, Beth Wilkinson, arguably as a party, we could do a sidebar on that, I'm sure. Yeah. Like I thought there was a potential standing issue, requested pursuant to FRAP 35 that panel opinion be reviewed by the full DC Circuit en banc. En banc relief was granted on July 30th. Unlike a grant of certiorari, which only requires 4 out of 9 Supreme Court justices, rehearing en banc requires a majority of the court to say, yeah, we want to take another look at that one. And in my practice, you can't read the tea leaves on granting a writ of cert necessarily. Mm-hmm. But I think granting en banc is a pretty strong indication that a majority of the court says, yeah, we're not so certain about that panel opinion.
Yeah, it'd
so,
be weird for them to be like, we also want to agree with the decision that already.
Right. So first embedded question, I think it was a good sign. Let me know if you disagree. Yep. Second, that I thought was strange was that the hearing, which will have been yesterday by the time this airs, directs the parties to address the no other adequate means to obtain the relief required standard, which again, you and I both agree is kind of a slam dunk in that the other means of obtaining the relief required is let Judge Sullivan rule on the 48A motion. And if he denies it, appeal in the ordinary course, right? Like that seems to be a pretty strong argument, but I thought the clear and indisputable right to relief was even stronger, right? Like, because then you don't have to speculate on the relief awarded. You don't entertain these, you know, sort of, well, it's the equivalent. Why not just have comity and address that? Now, like you would just say, yeah, you don't get mandamus if there's discretion, and 48A says that there's discretion. So you don't have an indisputable right to obtain that relief. Do you read anything into the fact that the court didn't want to hear about that prong of the argument?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, I agree with you that it's a good sign that they took it. I wasn't surprised that they took it because I think that panel opinion is pretty clearly wrong.
me too.
For the reasons we've talked about. And I'm not surprised the DC Circuit doesn't want that staying on their books as precedent, you know, concerning the law of mandamus, because it's just contrary to everything that mandamus is supposed to be about. In terms of what they limited the argument to, I'm not sure what to read into that. I mean, the other thing that I thought was interesting is you said they mentioned the recusal statute.
I was going to tee that up as the next question. So go ahead.
They weren't briefing on how the statute that requires judges to recuse themselves in certain cases, how that factors into Sullivan's petition. And I'm not sure what to make of that either, but it sounds like I think Sidney Powell has argued in the past that Sullivan should be recused, whatever else happens in the case. And it may be that they're willing to consider that at this point. They think Sullivan has gotten so deeply and sort of personally involved in this that he's almost become a party, in effect, even if not strictly speaking, that the recusal rules would require him to let another judge handle it. So that may be coming too.
I'm glad you flagged that. So a couple of days ago, the DC Circuit issued a supplemental order with respect to oral argument that said the party should be prepared to address that oral argument, the effect, if any, of the recusal statute, which is 28 U.S.C. 455. Right. And in particular, they flag subsection B5-1, which is that a judge shall disqualify himself in any proceeding in which his impartiality might be questioned, right? That's the catch-all. And B5-1 is the degree to which he is a party to the proceeding.
Right. Right. Which is pretty interesting because I'm sure you recall when he first petitioned, there were people arguing back and forth, well, Sullivan doesn't have standing to ask for en banc review because he's not a party.
Right.
And then people were arguing about, well, he's kind of in effect a party, even if he's not strictly a party. And now the DC Circuit seems to be suggesting maybe they think he has sort of become a party at this point, at least to the degree where his impartiality could be questioned and it would be appropriate for him to be recused. So
is that a way of sort of insulating themselves on the procedural question of saying, yeah, we treated Judge Sullivan as a party for purposes of standing under mm-hmm. FRAP 35 to request reconsideration, rehearing en banc. It's too late to raise the standing question.
Right.
We can't put the genie back in the bottle. So the relief we might craft would be to remand the case back to the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, but to reassign it to another judge.
Yeah, I guess they could be looking for sort of cover like that, like you're suggesting, although I'm not sure why they would need to, because the court can take it en banc on its own, right? So
yeah.
if they look at the fact that Sullivan filed the petition and they think, well, we don't really think that's quite right, he doesn't really have the power to do that, they can just say, but we're going to take it, right? So it becomes almost a meaningless question whether Sullivan technically had the right to petition or not.
Yeah. Kind of a harmless error.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know why they'd really be worried about that, but it's hard to say where they're going. You know, on the alternative remedy thing that you mentioned earlier, I mean, the one thing that was pretty interesting in the panel opinion is the fact that the harm, you know, so the panel opinion's decision was basically, well, there's no alternative remedy because if this motion goes forward, the government might have to explain why it did what it did. And that would improperly interfere with, you know, prosecutorial discretion. And that bell could not be unrung, right? But mm-hmm. the two things crazy about that is, first of all, it's a little crazy to say you can never ask the government to explain its prosecutorial decisions. I mean, that happens all the time. You know, what if there were allegations that the government was only prosecuting, you know, certain minority groups or something like that? And I mean, you know, it's not unheard of to have a judge ask the government to talk about why it made certain prosecutorial decisions. That doesn't inherently violate some executive branch prerogative. But even more importantly, the government didn't seek mandamus, right? only Flynn sought mandamus. And so the panel opinion took the harm to the government as the irreparable harm with no alternative remedy and let Flynn kind of piggyback on it, you know, which is another error I think that maybe the panel will point out, you know. Maybe even if you think the government is harmed by having to explain why it did what it did, which I don't think is a legitimate harm, but even if you think that's the case, that's not a harm to Flynn, right? And Flynn's the only one who sought mandamus. Flynn's got an alternative remedy. Let the judge rule and then appeal.
So how do you think that argument will factor into the D.C. Circuit's opinion? Where do you think they're going to come out? I'm pinning you down on a prediction here.
Oh, well, I think they're going to reverse it and send it back to Sullivan. Kind of looks like they might then, you know, order Sullivan to recuse himself.
Do we have any idea what effect that would have? Is it just a shot in the dark of what judge would take over kind of thing?
Yeah, I think it's a random, it would be like just another random assignment. I think it's that panel decision was pretty clearly wrong. And they're going to say, look, the judge gets to rule on this in the first instance, and then you can appeal. In this case, it's now we're talking about process, right? We've moved away from the substance, and lawyers like to get all excited about process. but you know, the point that it's really important to remember that, you know, just because this goes back to Sullivan, even if Sullivan keeps it, he might ultimately grant the motion.
Sure.
In fact, I think there's a better than 50-50 chance that he would at the end of the day.
Ooh, wow, that's a bold prediction.
Well, that's disappointing. You know,
that he would ultimately conclude, yeah, I don't really have the discretion here to deny it. But he'd only do that after a hearing and, you know, creating a record about why the government did what it did. And that alone would be a great benefit to the public, right? That's cast some sunlight on what exactly happened here.
That is exactly the position that we took in our amicus brief, right? Which is the court has the power to look behind the 48A motion, that the court is the only party that would then have any kind of interest in trying to detect, you know, any kind of unfair manipulation or abuse of the process. And that at minimum, Judge Sullivan ought to inquire, for example, why the line prosecutor, Brandon Van Grack, withdrew from the case the day the government filed its 48A motion. Right? Yep. And I think it's pretty clear from the case law that that at minimum, Judge Sullivan can say, I'd like to learn a little bit more about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think even the panel suggested, well, there could be extreme cases where, for example, the motion was filed as a result of a bribe, you know, where it would be inappropriate. Well, how do you find that out? You know, how do you find out if unless you hold a hearing? and have the government demonstrate why it did what it did, right? But I saw somebody commented right after the panel ruling came out, was the effect of this decision was, you know, somebody walks up to the prosecutor in court, gives him a suitcase full of cash. Prosecutor says, okay, Your Honor, we move to dismiss the case. And the judge isn't allowed to say, hey, what's up with that suitcase?
Right.
I mean, this sounds a lot like the arguments about the pardon power from the other week, Andrew, doesn't it?
It does, and that is sort of a perfect segue. As you may know, we had Judge Sugarman on a week ago to discuss the Roger Stone case and the commutation of Roger Stone sentencing. Again, because Jed had filed a petition to file an amicus brief before Judge Jackson, and
I thought it was amicus.
Here it goes.
All right. This is why you don't get invited back. See?
No, hasn't disqualified many. Look, if we stop inviting everyone who says amicus instead of amicus, we're not going to have any guests, Andrew.
Good point. So I thought the argument was really interesting, and I thought sort of fitting into the larger framework of, you know, do we look behind the commutation power. So I thought it was a good discussion. You also have a very, very interesting take on the Roger Stone commutation. And why don't you articulate that?
Well, I've argued you could look at the commutation, or if he ultimately gets a pardon, and analyze it under federal bribery law. So back at the time, 2 years ago or so during Mueller, when there were these reports about people floating the idea of pardons to Paul Manafort, and I think Michael Flynn, I think it was John Dowd. There were press reports that his lawyer might have talked to them about the president might pardon you. You know, there's a lot of speculation about, well, is that obstruction of justice? You know, could that be obstruction? And I argued that, and there were all these counter arguments by people who say, well, the president can't obstruct justice, you know, in his official capacity. But everybody agrees the president can commit bribery. And granting a pardon in exchange for agreeing not to testify against the president, or a commutation, to me, falls squarely within federal bribery law. And even William Barr said at his confirmation hearing that that would be a crime for a president to agree to pardon someone in exchange for a promise not to testify against him. So it's, you can call it bribery of a witness, where the president is giving a thing of value, the commutation, to a witness to influence their testimony. And the argument here would be that, you know, he gave it to Stone
to influence the testimony to zero.
And Stone, or encourage him not to testify. And I forget the exact wording of the statute, but they're, you know, to absent themselves from the proceeding or refuse to provide information or influence their testimony. And, you know, Stone was pretty public about saying, I'm never going to testify against the president. You know, I'm not. And Trump was pretty public about calling him a stand-up guy, and he had guts. And then he grants the commutation after Stone repeatedly refuses to testify. And, you know, on its face, that looks like a suspicious case for the president bribing a witness, basically.
So let's push it at the edges of that in a couple of ways. First, we cite to you and we point people to your Sidebar's blog article from, I think, 3 years ago now on the Supreme Court's McDonald decision, right? Involving former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, who very clearly, you know, accepted, you know, fur coats for his wife and riding around in a Ferrari and you know, the actual suitcase full of cash, right? All sorts of stuff. And the Supreme Court 9-0 said, well, that's not bribery, right? Aren't you the authority for the federal bribery statute is essentially toothless and impossible to prove?
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far, but it's certainly been narrowed.
I might have poisoned the well a little bit on that. But
the issue of McDonald is not a problem here, because the issue in McDonald was a very narrow statutory question of what's an official act, right? And so he didn't dispute that he got all those gifts. But he argued that the things he did in exchange, which were pretty minor, just sending some emails, trying to set up some meetings, things like that, did not rise to the level of a quote-unquote official act as defined in the statute, which has a very precise definition, and the court agreed with him. So that would not be an issue here because, or for two reasons. First of all, even if you flip the bribery statute around the other way, which I think you could also do, you could say Stone is bribing Trump.
I was actually going to ask if that if his defense could be, well, I've been consistent that I was never going to testify against Trump. There has never been any question of my you know, behavior. But then when you put it the other way, that's almost offering ahead of time a bribe to Trump.
Yes. And when I wrote the blog about this bribery issue a couple of years ago, there's two different scenarios. The first one I mentioned earlier is Trump bribing a witness. Bribery of a witness is prohibited by the statute. But the other option is you could say the witness is bribing Trump, that the witness is providing Trump with a thing of value, which is my promise not to testify, because thing of value is construed very broadly. It doesn't have to be cash, you know, anything of, including intangibles that are of value to the public official. And in exchange, the official act that Trump is doing is granting the pardon or the commutation. But there's no question under McDonald that granting a commutation would qualify as an official act. That is a formal exercise of government power, unlike the things that McDonald did, which was just, you know, send an email, set up a meeting. I mean, Trump is taking a formal government decision and making it. And so even under McDonald, I don't think that's a problem.
I am persuaded that it is an official act, and I think that was a great clarification. I mean, in evaluating it, certainly from in thinking about how I would try that case, I think the characterization of Stone bribing Trump may actually be the stronger argument, because that it's going to be easier to prove intent, right? Like that. I mean, that it seems to me that's the hardest part of any of these statutes is meeting the intent requirement.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, this can look really smelly, and a lot of stuff can look really smelly, but jumping from there to saying you can prove bribery beyond a reasonable doubt to a unanimous jury of 12 people in a contested trial, that's a big jump, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff that looks really sleazy and slimy in politics in particular, that you could never actually make a provable criminal case. And I'm not saying this would be an easy case. You'd have to develop some additional evidence, I think, to back up the fact that they really had an understanding. But you're right.
Well, give me an example of what you might look for as additional evidence to support that inference.
Well, I mean, if we're in an ideal world, you know, you find some kind of communication, emails between them or some meeting that another witness was at where they discussed it, or you know, some other evidence demonstrating that there was, in fact, a deal, because that's what you've got to prove beyond reasonable doubt. And so, you know, if you have just timing, you know, you take a different kind of example, you know, company XYZ gives massive contributions to a politician, and the politician goes out and votes in favor of some bill that the company wants passed. Well, that certainly looks suspicious, you know, and it certainly raises a lot of concerns about money influencing politics and things like that. But unless you've got really concrete evidence that there was a specific deal made, that's not going to be a bribe. That's like politics as usual in Washington. You know?
Drain the swamp. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think, you know, there's a pretty strong prima facie case, you know, of, you know, it looks like Stone and Trump are operating with the same understanding, and they were pretty blatant about being public about it with Twitter and everything else. But I don't know that you've got enough yet where you could take that to a jury. I mean, I think you'd have to try to do some additional investigation and try to find something more concrete, whether it was a phone call between them or an email exchange or a conversation someone else overheard that they could testify about, or Stone flips and testifies, but he'd be such an incredible witness. I don't think you'd ever base a case on him.
Let me parse what you just said and ask it back to you this way. You're rehired as a prosecutor and you bring this case, and I inexplicably am hired by Roger Stone to be his defense counsel. It seems to me that you're saying that I could argue Roger Stone very publicly made it be known that he was loyal to this president. He absolutely hoped that the president would reward him for this loyalty, but the state will never be able to prove, because it did not happen, that there was an explicit quid pro quo, that there was an agreement, that there was an email, that there was a document, that there was a phone call in which the president said, hey, I need you to be quiet. And my client said yes. And so at the end of the day, what you have is a very loyal political follower and a president that rewarded that loyalty. But that does not rise to the crime of bribery.
Yeah,
I could make that argument.
Yeah, I think you could do even better.
This is why Stone is not going to hire me. So go ahead.
All you got to do is raise reasonable doubt, as you know, right? I mean, you've got to raise a doubt in the mind of one juror, and your client gets off. So Stone's defense is, if you look back at my tweets, what I was saying all the time was, I won't lie against the president. They want me to lie and you know, make up stories against him to get him in trouble. I won't turn on him. In fact, there was nothing there. There was nothing for me to give them about the president, but they wanted me to lie, and I refused to do that. So, you know, I was not altering my testimony or to doing anything to benefit Trump other than telling the truth and refusing to lie when the prosecutors pressured me to. And Trump would say, not that he was actually rewarding Stone, but that because this entire Mueller witch hunt was so outrageous, as has been, you know, and he'd point to other things that allegedly documented all the outrages by the FBI and things like that, that he thought it was terrible that the prosecutors were trying to pressure Stone to make him lie, and it was appropriate for him to commute the sentence in the interest of justice. But there was never any kind of a deal for Stone not to testify against him because there was never anything to testify about.
Now I'm depressed.
Yeah, it was the all the Russia hoax, right?
This seems like we should add, maybe amend the bribery laws to our growing list of things that the incoming administration should do in 2021.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a bill, I think it was Adam Schiff actually introduced it just recently, to amend the bribery statute to specifically say that granting a pardon or act of clemency, you know, would be an official act, would be in exchange for, you know, refusing to testify or something would be an official act. And I've argued, you know, that there's nothing wrong with adding that to the statute as a clarification, but I think it's already covered.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think I agree with you on that.
They're also trying to make self-pardons illegal. They want to pass a statute that says self-pardons are illegal. Yeah.
I want to do a symposium on self-pardon because I think it is within the president's power. Jed certainly argued to the contrary, and sounds like you have kind of a nuanced position. So so let's get you back on, and we'll do self-pardoning.
We'll all self-pardon.
Well, Randall, thank you so much for coming on. We've plugged Sidebar's blog, and obviously you write not infrequently for the Washington Post. Anything you want folks to go take a look at?
Actually, there's one thing I'm kind of excited about in a couple of months. Are you familiar with the Great Courses?
Oh, yeah.
They, you know, produce video courses of classes by different professors. So I have completed a course with them on White Collar Criminal Law Explained. And it's 24 lectures. It's been about a 2-year project, but it's going to come out in a couple of months. And if people want to look for that, I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, that sounds amazing. And obviously, you are an incredible legal communicator. And when that comes out, we will have you back on specifically to refresh and remind everyone that that's out there. I can't wait. I mean, I'm going to buy that when that comes out and listen to it. That's going to be awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Take care.
Thanks again to Professor Randall Eliason. And Andrew, I know you wanted to say a word or two about that interview.
I think that we have staked out really kind of a unique opinion, right? So this, you will be getting this episode as the DC Circuit is conducting oral arguments. So in real time, and our prediction, you know, in advance, is that what the DC Circuit is going to do is reverse, remand back to the District Court for the District of Columbia to conduct some level of oversight as to whether the court is going to grant the government's Rule 48A motion. And I think to insulate from charges of bias that they're going to either require, I'm going to say require, let's go out on that limb. Jeez. Either require or strongly suggest that Judge Sullivan recuse himself. And let me point out that this would be a great result, right?
Really?
It would be a great result because the case would be assigned to another judge. The facts remain the facts. And as we've argued in our amicus brief, right? We're not even arguing that Judge Sullivan should not grant the motion to dismiss. What we're saying is that Judge Sullivan should have a hearing, should bring in the parties, should require the government to produce line prosecutor Brandon Van Grack, who resigned the day the government withdrew from the case, the day the government filed its motion to dismiss. And if this is reassigned to a clean judge, right, that judge has every reason in the world to look over at Sidney Powell and say, okay, you asked that Judge Sullivan recuse himself. He did so. You've got a fresh judge with no preconceived notion, but I don't know anything about this case, right?
Yeah. Who is this Trump person you keep. Right.
Wait, who's this individual one who is president of the United States? No, but it is 100% a justification, an ironclad justification that nobody can argue for, nobody can argue against, that says, but now we're going to have a hearing, right? Now I'm going to listen to the reasons why the government is moving to dismiss this case, and I'm going to ask questions, and I'm going to develop a full record so that I can do what the district, what the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit instructed me to do. It would be an absolute win. It would be great, and lots of liberal sources would, I think, jump to sort of despair if the D.C. Circuit orders that Judge Sullivan recuse himself. But I don't think that's the right read. I don't think it's the right read from an outcome standpoint. And I think it's a pretty decent argument that, if we're basing the grant of review en banc on Judge Sullivan as a party petitioning for en banc review, well, then the disqualification rules seem pretty clear, right? He's a party. Okay. You could petition. You got it. But now let's give the case to somebody else. I'm okay with that.
Well, I for one, am going to miss him. I've written him so much. So I'm worried that it could just be replaced with a way less good judge. But we'll see. So prediction
could be,
down.
But it could be. It could be replaced with a great judge, right? We could get Amy Berman Jackson, right? Like, okay. There are lots of really good judges in DDC. So,
all right. Well, everybody, we'll take note of the prediction. We like to be held accountable here, and mostly that means I get to say Andrew was wrong about something. I'm never held accountable. It's easy. It's a nice job. No, just kidding. Like the bar exam this week. We're ride or die together, Andrew.
All right.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats over on patreon.com/law, enjoying all the goodies. And now here's a new one on the list. At Casa Agria is the best brewery. At Emperor's Brewery is a close second.
Ooh. Nice.
Congrats on making the list. Stoic Paralegal, Alexander Davies, and those may be new as well. I can't remember. Great Dooku Tree. Yeah, I think we used to just start with Great Dooku Tree. So some new additions. Congrats. Thomas Kleberg, Bradford Katie, Mary Perez, Amicus Flinch. Yeah, or Amicus Flinch, as some people would say. That's nothing. Is it Atticus? No, Atticus. Dan from Deerfield, I won't tell another dicta joke until Trump is out of office. The Transformers Ghostbusters crossover was great, but it's the Quintessens SCOTUS crossover I'm waiting for. Ann Schmeckel, hold up. I actually like real property. You all keep talking about Ritz. I'm going to want some clown horn and crackers. Two fabulous lesbians who just got married. Oh, congrats. William Drew Collins, Bob Newhouse, Sassy Italy Tours will use a truck to stop Nazis from running into Black Lives Matter protesters. Greg Kreimer, 100 seconds to the canonical debate, a string of uninteresting characters. Imagine the G. Carlin 2020 album. I pronounce it G off in my head. Weird. I guess Murder Hornets were just a filler episode. Cheeky Breaky, my pinned tweet at Hans Royal is a detailed thread with evidence of the disinformation campaign to bring federal troops into Chicago. Interesting. The U.S. has turned into a country I don't like or recognize. Vote to take back our country. Mike Hall, Hornbook Law is a primer. That's pronounced primer, you ninny. It's not paint. Samuel Bland, fly like a hot dog, Freedom Eagle. Angry Macface, say it with me. Amicus. Ugh. Matthew McConaughey portraying Matthew McConaughey. This is not the greatest Patreon name in the world. No, this is just a tribute. Center Black Trans Sex Workers. Stop. Ask a question a president of Finland would ask. The Books That Burn podcast, reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. Wear a mask. Vote in overwhelming numbers. We can do this. Wear a mask. It's polite. This episode brought to you by the letter Q for quarantine. Come to Minneapolis for the future live show. Stay because of the seemingly inevitable second lockdown. This Patreon name paid for by Lionel Hutz for SCOTUS committee. He's more qualified than Brett Kavanaugh. Haney Maxwell. Hey, Rocky, watch me pull an executive order out of my ass. That trick never works. Yikes, I better get another ass. I don't do that the same as Andrew because I don't know Rocky Bullwinkle at all. Trump is doing the things right-wing conspiracies said Obama would do. Yeah. In Illinois, we pronounce it Illinois. make Steve King an author again. Hey, update your patron name. We've already done that. Murray Gregerson. Andrew is my favorite undeclared congressional candidate. Thomas is a close second. Ah, oh, thanks. Howler Monkeys, turning dicta into dogma, one case at a time. The venerable Richard Milhouse Nixon. Ian Buckley, donate to restore Florida voting rights at wegotthevote.org/fines and fees. Not that Chris Wallace, just effing vote blue. Jake Braun, the door was framed, the knob turned on it. Stupid. Give to modestneeds.org, give to modestneeds.org. Christopher Brown, she's got dumps like a Trump. Drump, drump, vote him out like what, vote out is dumb. Yes. Okay. Lawful Copter says, of course, Trump isn't throwing out the Yankees' first pitch. He's dropped the ball on literally everything else. Virtual law school with a third grader. What could go wrong? Can we get cert to appeal all of Thomas's incorrect T3BE answers? Start a co-op. Brad in Texas. There's a goat. Why is there a goat? Rob M. Andrew Seidel's butt wears a mask and social distances to avoid ultra-virus exposure. Zirkle. Podcasters' lives matter too. I'm pledging $250 a month for Patreon creators. Just don't tell my wife. Odin wants to defund the Paw Patrol. I want more briefs. Polly Hernandez. The previous patron name is true. The next patron name is false. Caveman tampers a norm now really is an anagram of person, woman, man, camera, TV. Okay. All right. Emily Rainbow Spence. Stocking up on lung injectable bleach. Gratuitous death escrow is my laser beam monstrosity cover band. Terry Cannon, Jason Copas, ensure your mail-in vote isn't rejected. Check for requirements such as witnesses, correct color pen, or exact signature. By the way, in my mind, I misread witnesses as whiteness, and I was like, Republicans would have that be a requirement for voting. Punching fascists is not enough. Get into good trouble. Hotspear asks if we're invading our own country now because of travel restrictions. Take donation advice from a podcast, FFRF, EFF, ACLU, Modest Needs, and Our Damn Patreon. Whew, your turn, Andrew.
Thank you, too. Japanese Caravan Synchronized Swim Team Destination Portland. Nate Drex, a string of unfathomable Trump quotes. Now that Big Brother has started, we can all stay in quarantine until it's all over. Okay. 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. Save the USPS. They are essential for small businesses and our democracy. Yeah. Volunteer for your candidate today and take back your government. Jennifer Kratch, Jay Cheever Loophole. Diogenes the Cynic was right. Jeff Gelback. I'm going to say the amicus shall inherit the earth, but I love the amicus shall inherit the earth. Wash your hands, then vote for Joe Biden. Stephen Balticate Sandoval, welcome back to the full name, Stephen. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. John Bilderback, Sunday was the 46th anniversary of Nixon resigning. Time for the 46th president. Ooh, I like that. Antifa assistant to the regional manager for Southern Ohio, Philip Kaiser. Andrea, the arbitrary and capricious. You'll have to speak up. I'm wearing a towel. Fantastic. Eric Altman, superior may be going too far, but I'd like a show comparing civil law versus common law systems. Yeah, me too. Me fail presidenting, that's impossible. If I were Susan Collins looking at Maine polls, I'd be very concerned. Yeah, I think so too. I don't know if they're bluffing or what, but you know, we talked about that on SAO. Moot would be my favorite word if it weren't so redundant. Absion. Therese Chan, Payne Strumpet, Trambolus, holy clown horn, my baby slept 6 straight hours last night, best night of my life. Mm. The Wandering Gambler, Akatarawa, Japan. I say this at least twice a week. Milo Mead Song stands in solidarity with the UW nurses and their union. Guy Chapman, Death Escrow, karaoke only songs by dead artists. Oh, I do that. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Wait, wrong list. These are the people who signed Kanye's petition. James K. Lawyer, comedian, guest, microphone, podcast. That is excellent. Ah, breath. Ah. Chad T. Anonymous. Siege Megatron's overly elastic lip animations. Yeah, that is true. Hope you are all safe and well. Have a good week. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Impeach Thomas's penguin. Oh, wow. Those are fighting words. Closing concessions. Air Bud 435, Barker of the House. Maybe the real Conrad Michaels is the friends we made along the way. Liz Weeks. Weasel Stronghold to Major Tom, request new varmint hammer. We're giving him hell, sir. Adam Costa, Jay Aldenwalt. Okay, fine. I'll vote for Joe Biden. Would you quit bothering me already? Jeez. Well, see, it works. Amicus Briefs. Yeah, that's right. That's consistent vowel usage there. Amicus Briefs. Big Easy Blasphemy. The Yodeler is preparing for a fiery reentry. If a lawsuit has no briefs, it is going commando. Ronda 2020 because WTF not. R.A.P. Cobalt, the best pitbull ever. He stopped suffering August 3rd, 2020. Well, I'm glad he stopped suffering. We're sorry for your loss. Malaika Chandler, Poot Quackintush, Soggy Pants, Matthew Vernon, adopt a homeless pet and oppose decline and ear docking. Sakashite Fukusumi, donate to the Lebanese Red Cross at supportlrc.app. Don't take legal advice from Laserbeam Monstrosity Attorney at Law, Heather L., David in Brooklyn, Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Alley, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, Humpity Pumpity, Mitchell, No Commute, So Behind on Podcasts. You can tune a piano, but you can't tune a fish.
Right, I just still can't get over Humpity Pumpity. The fun. I can't even explain it. You would have to hear the god-awful movies bonus thing that I did. It's just mind-blowing that phrase exists.
Sam Buck, Natasha Crunchwrap wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute. Okay. I agree with that 100%. And of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be dethroned, Conrad Michaels. Thank you all so much for supporting the show over patreon.com/law. And, you know, you're the best. We love each and every one of you, and we love you more than anyone else.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. It's the answer. Andrew, how did we do?
All right. Since we've already made bold predictions in this episode, I'm going to cut right to the chase. You and I got this one right, Dennis.
All right.
That seemed like the right answer to me, but I was not 100% sure. So let's look in this case. I'm going to go and read directly from the answer key, which says answer D is correct. The farmer was privileged to use reasonable force to prevent or end a trespasser's intrusion upon his land. Okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Or to protect his property. But he was not privileged to use force that threatened serious bodily injury unless he himself was in danger of serious bodily harm. Again, makes total sense. So that's why the excessive force is the key inquiry there. It makes sense out of the 10-year-old, right? Like, because presumably, like, you don't feel like you're in danger for your life when a 10-year-old is on your property.
The farmer was 8 years old. We don't know.
I think that it would have been required to tell us that in the fact pattern. I also want to read the answer option C is incorrect. The farmer was not required to have posted a warning in order to have had a privilege to protect his property by the use of reasonable force. Although the absence of a warning sign may become a factor in determining whether the steps he took were in fact reasonable. In evaluating whether his actions were reasonable as a defense of his property, the court will ask whether the force he used was excessive. So I'm not sure I understand that although, comma, because I am with you. Like, signs that describe what your common law duty is are meaningless, right? Like,
yeah.
God. It's like posting a big sign that says, don't break the law.
Yeah, like, do I have to law, put asshole? A sticky note on all my possessions that says, don't steal me?
Yeah, right.
There's no sticky note on his watch, Your Honor. So, damn, you're right. All right, well, we're victorious.
Yeah, we did great.
And not only that, you got a bunch of stooges to guess other answers by telling them. that was kind of a dirty trick, but, you know, I like it. Well, hop in your time machine and maybe there will be a nice answer to read that will either be the wrong one or somehow be funny or something.
Well, Thomas, this week's winner with an incorrect answer is Natalie Lips on Twitter, who says, I was going to guess C before, Andrew. If my libertarian property professor taught me anything except that he's a lunatic, it's that you need to warn someone to get off your land before you use force, whether they're a child or not, even if it's a sign that won't do anything. Well, congratulations on the double whammy. We love that you took two shots at libertarianism and got it wrong. So congratulations. With this kind of challenge, you're this week's winner. Everyone, give Natalie a follow on Twitter. She is at Natalie_ _lips, NATALIE _LIPS. And congratulations, sort of, on being this week's winner.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks again to Professor Randall Eliason for coming on. I'm really excited about his class coming up, his great courses coming up. That's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll have him back on to talk about it. And we will see you all on Friday.
Until then.
He's not even a lawyer and he's kicking your ass.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community: Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.